His first taste of Formula One was alongside one of the greatest there's ever been.
It was McLaren, and the other side of the garage was Ayrton Senna. Looking back on it, you think, wow, what a baptism of fire in a way, but at the time, you just get in and do it. When he drove, his level of feedback, he was actually going into a lot more detail. And that was where I realised, actually, if you want to be in this sport, then you've got to put in so much more effort.
But soon after witnessing Senna's genius, Alan McNish suffered a severe setback on his Formula One journey.
Unfortunately, when I was 21, I was ill, and I had a virus that knocked a lot of the momentum out of my career. Just had no energy. My joints were swollen up. I couldn't put pressure onto the pedal to be lifted out of the car in Hockenheim. I think the spotlight and the momentum went in that era.
More than a decade later, in 2002, Alan finally made his Formula One breakthrough with Toyota. He was in his early 30s by then, and in reality, his chance had come too late, and it was over after just one season. Now he's back in the F1 paddock with Audi, a team he enjoyed huge success with in sports cars. When they take over Sauber in 2026, can Audi uphold their exceptional racing pedigree in the pinnacle of motorsport? Here on F1 Beyond the Grid, with me, Tom Clarkson, Alan talks about his role in Audi's F1 project and how they'll go racing with Nico Hülkenberg and Gabriel Bortoleto. Alan's input will be truly beneficial to Audi because he's very experienced and has spent a lot of time in the presence of true greats. You'll hear brilliant insight from that first McLaren test alongside Ayrton Senna and the invaluable advice Alan received from 1976 world champion James Hunt. His perspective on why Toyota didn't succeed in Formula One is also very enlightening. Given that there were 13 years between his first F1 test drive and his Grand Prix debut, Alan's dedication and perseverance to reach the top of his sport is a lesson to all young drivers. I hope you enjoy hearing his story. Alan, it's great to have you on the show. How are things?
Yeah, very good. Thank you very much. Great to be here. First time on the show. Long time listener, as you say.
Well, look, let's start by talking about the Audi F1 project. Can you describe the atmosphere at the moment over in Hinwil and Neuburg, and what's the level of excitement there?
Anticipation, isn't it? You know, 2026 is just around the corner. It's been a long time since it was announced. If you think back to Spa 22, when the cover was pulled off the liveried show car, and then it was clear that Audi was entering Formula One for the first ever time. And since then, there's been a lot of work going on predominantly in Neuburg, where all of the previous motorsport programs were running out of to build the power unit, and then latterly as well in Hinwil and the developments there, which I think everybody's obviously very much focused on today, because, you know, you've still got a racing season that continues at the moment, but the big eye is on Melbourne 2026.
Now, you're an Audi legend from sports car racing, but describe what your role is now in an F1 context.
Do multiple things, actually, at the moment, because when we started with the Formula One project, then I was involved from the beginning looking at how this could come around, you know, what was the best way to do it, because, you know, obviously there's different elements of experiences in there, and that sort of built up through the time in Neuburg back from, you know, the beginning of this decade in reality when it was building towards it. And now more latterly on some of the areas, I look at the key technical partnerships, which is something that's obviously very fundamental to how Formula One teams run. And also one of the areas that I personally love is also just the interaction with drivers as well. And that's something that I think when you're a driver, you're always a driver. You never take that part of you out of it.
Look, we'll come on to drivers. Can we talk about, I don't know how we describe this, the Audi way, all right? Now, you race for them for 11 years. You had great success. But also before you, they were dominant in rallying. How would you describe the Audi way when it comes to motorsport? Why have they got such a phenomenal record?
They have got a phenomenal record because every works program they've ever got involved in, back from rallying through to touring car to Le Mans, as you mentioned, which was the area where I predominantly touched into, or Formula E, or even Rallycross and Dakar, they've won. And so from that point of view, it's been a tremendous success. And the trophy cabinet is sensational, no question about it. I think probably one base point is that the whole Audi company, the DNA is technology. You know, Vorsprung durch Technik is just exactly the statement. And so from that perspective, it's looked at as a technological development. And every racing program has to have a relevance as well. It can't just be a marketing activity. It's got to have a technical relevance. And we saw that very much through the different programs. You mentioned Rally in their Quattro, for example, or, you know, TFSI direct injection. And now with the change to the regulations in 26, it's always got a relevance there. And I think that's one of the key points, because they look at it with a long-term vision. And so historically, you know, when they've gone into a program, it's been with, I would say, a very clear view over why and where, and with the ultimate goal to win, because there's no point going into a program if you're not going in with a vision to win. And thankfully, myself and a lot of drivers have been on the positive end of that. I think there's one other factor, though, which is very difficult to describe, but we've always had very good people leading projects. So if I think back to my time when I joined, I shook hands with Dr. Ulrich, who was then motorsport boss, and that was in November. I still was in a contract with another OEM at the time, and he was comfortable in waiting on a handshake, not in a written agreement, but on a handshake. And that principle is very old-fashioned, but it's one that I think has stood them very well. And that human development of a team, a personal team, that maybe from the outside has looked like a big German powerhouse, but actually from the inside has had a very strong leadership, but with a velvet glove mentality behind it.
Alan, that handshake story says a lot about you, actually, as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, or you could also say didn't have many other options. No, the reality is that, you know, I think generational aspects to it there is that you make a commitment. It's a verbal commitment. You shake a hand and that's how it is, and you follow it through for the good, the bad and the ugly of it all. And it's a principle, I would say, more than anything else.
The Formula One project is still very new. I want you to describe a Le Mans campaign. I want to learn more about Audi's approach to racing, right? So you're going to Le Mans. When do the preparations start? Just give us an idea about the thoroughness of Audi and the extents they go to for the success that you were describing.
Well, for Le Mans, it was a very clear point that it was one race per year. And the other races that we did in sports cars were to some extent to fill the gap between Le Mans. And Le Mans was your one, the big one. And everything was centered around about
that. Were the other races used as a warm-up to Le Mans? We're
trialing
Sebring things
12 out. Hours. So if you take the Sebring 12 hours, biggest, most difficult sports car race in America, we would go to do that particular race. Even if we weren't doing the full American Championship, we'd go and do that race as a complete team unit, drivers, engineers, mechanics, a lot. And then once we finished the 12 hours on the Sunday, all of the fans used to leave the circuit. And then on the Monday morning at 9 o'clock, we'd start another 12 hours. And so then you would test for 12 hours to give 24. Now, the 24 hours as a test wasn't enough, but 24 hours roundabout Sebring was physically for the car, for the dynamics, for the suspension geometry, for the drive shafts, for the, you know, the drive boots, everything was the same as 30 hours in Le Mans. So for us, that was our first endurance test. Then we go to Paul Ricard and we do two other endurance tests where you would run for 30 hours.
Non-stop.
And if the turbo failed, you came in and you changed the turbo, as if it was a live race. You would do safety car periods as if it was a live race. If it rained, you just put the wet tires on and you went as if it was a live race. So the whole team was in this sort of process. By the time you came to Le Mans, you had done 3 or 4 24 hours of Le Mans by the time you got there. But I think when you said, when does it start? When we finished Le Mans, even if we won or lost, didn't matter. The next day was when the process started for the following one. In fact, I'm sure the design guys, Axel Luffler, who was the chief designer, he was already thinking 2 or 3 years ahead. There's no question about it there. And same on the engine department. But from the racing team side, then it was definitely the next day. When you said, what did it look like? The biggest single thing for me, and it's what I loved about Audi and love about Audi, was you won or you lost. If you won, you celebrated for the night, and then the next day you got back to it. If you lost, there was no pointing of fingers or anything else. It was black and white, you lost. Just go home and fix it and get on with it. And so you come back with a very clear attitude. And there's times when there was frustration, there was no question about it. There's a few races where, you know, we came back and we pulled our hair out for a few days. But the reality was there's a very quick reset and got back to the job in hand. How do we improve?
And so how different is the F1 program to the sports car program? I mean, you can't test in Formula One now.
No, you can't. But since my era of driving, you know, through our Formula E project, for example, we couldn't test there. There was very limited amount of testing. But, you know, you've got simulation and simulators that have came on scene. You've got different dyno systems. So you basically do a lot of preparation in the virtual world now. And then you have got your physical on-track preparation, which is limited. And that's for drivers and team engineers, the whole unit. And so in that respect, it's definitely a little bit of a different world. But the reality is that the technical world's moved on as well. And I think there you will see that from a power unit point of view, you're pretty much there by the time they actually get bolted into the back of the car. You know, you've got all your energy management done and things like that. It's just the way we are now.
Can we talk about the PU? Because you've got a going concern in Sauber, right? Mm-hmm. The chassis side is rolling from one year to the next. Of course, there's the big regulation changes. But for me, when I look at Audi, the PU is a huge project.
Yeah, yeah. For all power unit manufacturers.
For everybody. But it's like you've had to create a business and get the new regs sorted as well. How far down the road are you now? Can you give us any idea as to what's running on the dyno?
Look, at this stage, we're in October. You know, you're going to be running in January. So from that point of view, you know where we are in terms of things moving. You've got to go back when the regulations were finalized. Already, you were tight on time to make 2026. That's the realities of, you know, all of the power unit manufacturers and the timelines that are required. It's a big change. You've got a completely different philosophy on the power unit, on the internal combustion engine, also in the electrical side of it as well. You've got the chassis regulations. I think it's the biggest change we'll have ever seen. It's exciting in so many ways, but the timelines for it are pretty long. There's no question about it. And now we're at the last moments before, you know, everything gets homologated and gets ready for 26.
What's been the process, though? Do you start with a one-cylinder engine on the dyno and then work from there?
Yeah, everybody starts with a one-cylinder engine concepts and then build it up from there. And then it'll be, you know, I don't think anybody's different to full internal combustion engine and electrification and the full PU unit and on the dyno gearbox, then eventually a full car, and then you see it going testing.
This episode is sponsored by Babbel. As we enter the final months of 2025, it's a natural moment to reflect on what we've achieved and what we'd still love to cross off the list before the year's out. For me, learning something new always feels like time well spent, and picking up a new language, that's right up there. It opens doors to travel, culture, conversation, and Babbel is a great place to start. What I really like is that Babbel's lessons are based around real-life conversations. So you're learning words and phrases you'll actually use and not just textbook vocab you might have learned in school. It even offers tailored lessons for work scenarios, which is such a useful way to boost your confidence and your career options. The app keeps you motivated too, with progress trackers and real-time feedback that gently push you forward. It really is like having a mini language coach in your pocket. And with over a dozen languages to choose from, including French, Spanish, Italian, and German, you can find one that fits your goals. Right now, Babbel is offering our listeners up to 60% off their subscription. Go to babbel.com/grid to claim your discount. That's babbel.com/grid for up to 60% off. Valid for a limited time only. Babbel, language learning that works. Well, look, you're going to be going testing with Nico Hülkenberg and Gabriel Bortoleto. You were saying earlier that once a driver, always a driver. Are these two guys a perfect blend of youth and experience?
So Nico, I think you saw in Silverstone exactly why you put him in a car. you know, difficult conditions, the experience there, the skill, the balance, the mentality, everything else was just sensational. And he pulled a podium out of something that, you know, you never thought halfway through the race was going to be a podium. And then with Gabby, it's quite clear, you know, Formula 3 champion first year, Formula 2 champion first year, not a bad result, is it really? And he's got a very level, calm head about him. And I think it is exactly a perfect scenario where you've got someone that has got that experience, someone that is fresh into the environment with so much potential, but also the two of them work together very well. They're not political, they're not fighting against each other. They realize that actually there is quite a long journey ahead, and they've got to work together, and the whole team aspect at both sides of the garage working together as well. And I think the drivers lead that to a great extent.
Well, I'm interested that you've gone for youth and experience, whereas the other newcomers coming in next year, Cadillac, have gone for experience and experience with Bottas and Perez. Why a difference for Audi? Why is it important for you guys to have a young guy in one of the cars?
I don't think it's a strategy. You have to have a young guy. You've got to have the two best people that you think you can put into the car to build the team at the right time. And from my point of view, it was always clear that Bortoleto was going to have a long career in Formula 1. You know, you don't have the results that he has had with the performance, with the level-headed way that he approached Qatar and Abu Dhabi last year as an example. You know, that was a perfect scenario where you could sit there and say, actually, this is someone that has got brain capacity to spare. And, you know, I think that was quite a straightforward decision, to be honest with you, personally. And then on the other side of it, Nico fitted the build for developing a team. You know, he's got the experience of that. He's got the experience of teams at different stages in the grid as well, from, you know, higher up the grid to lower down in the grid. And I think that's a very, very important thing as well. So for it wasn't necessarily we have to have one that's here and one that's there. It was a case of who's the best people that we think for going into this.
So the Hulk has got, what, 240-odd races under his belt?
I think it's more than that.
Yeah. But I'm fascinated as to how you assess Bortoleto's progress this year. I remember in Melbourne he came in and was good in qualifying. Yeah. I think he put it over Hülkenberg in his first race, which was hugely impressive. Then it felt like it got harder work for a while, and then it got better from Austria onwards. How do you explain his trajectory this year?
I think the trajectory, if you looked at it, is probably a little bit the trajectory of the car and the team as well. I don't think it's necessarily drive, just driver related. You know, I think the car is now developed. It's a little bit more stable. His team of engineers working together, both sides of the garage, in fact, because, you know, both drivers were fresh to the team. And you see that whole team building up, understanding what's making the car click, where it needs to work on its weaker areas, where its strengths are. And it's quite clear that Gabriel's, I think, understood how to get to the point by the time he goes into quali to deliver a strong and consistent lap.
Is quali where you've seen him make the biggest gains?
I think it's easier to look in quali than it is in the race, because the race is also masked by a few other things. But, you know, he's had a good row of points there coming up. And so in that respect, you've got to say that the quali has allowed the race deliveries. And so I think that, like I said, I think there's two parts to it. One is that he has developed got the experience, but also the car has allowed him to do it a wee bit more than it maybe did at the beginning of the year.
I'm fascinated by his qualifying pace, because I've always looked at Hülkenberg actually as more of a Saturday man than a Sunday man.
Yeah.
Has it surprised you?
Yes. Yeah, I have to be honest with you. Yes. But I don't believe Nico has gone to bed fast and woken up slow. Simple fact.
No, I'm not implying that either. So I think what does this say about Gabby?
Yeah. I think Gabby has done a fantastic job. I think Nico has done a fantastic job in other areas. And it's the way that it floats around. I think you've seen it with a couple of other teams as well, where one driver suddenly started to have, I would say, what you would call the upper hand. But in reality, I'm pretty sure by the time we get to the end of the year, it'll be pretty nip and tuck.
We had Gabby on the show quite recently. And
what did you think?
I really enjoyed talking to him. He's interesting. Hmm. And there's no such thing as, you know, a difficult question for him. He will come up with an intelligent answer to most things. Mm-hmm. And if he doesn't want to talk about it, he'll find a way of sort of circumnavigating any potential pitfalls. I thought it was an enjoyable chat. Do you know what? And one of the things that inspired me about the chat was Senna is clearly a huge inspiration to him. And isn't it great to have a full-time Brazilian back on the grid? And actually talking about Senna, I feel, is a nice segue, Alan, into talking more about your racing career. Because what was it, 1989, I think, was the first time you tested the McLaren at Estoril?
Yeah, 89, just before Macau, because I flew directly to Macau.
From Estoril?
Well, I didn't. I flew back to Heathrow on a private jet and then got an economy BA to go to Hong Kong. Very different sort of scenarios. You can see the difference between Formula 1 and Formula 3 but even then.
Alan, you were the talk of the town. Can we talk about that
Which
first?
Town? Yes,
exactly. What about that first test in Estoril? Can you just give us your memories? You know, it wasn't a small back of the grid team. You were bam, straight in with the front running team of the day.
Yeah, it was McLaren, and the other side of the garage was Ayrton Senna. So, you know, you were 100% in there. And looking back on it, you think, wow, you know, what a baptism of fire in a way. But at the time, you just get in and do it. You don't think about it too much. What I remember was Estoril was the old Estoril circuit configuration. So just honking fast corners at the end of the day, long, very fast corners. And there was no data. So we're talking about the World Championship dominant team, Honda, power unit, McLaren chassis. First thing is, I jumped in the car, steering wheel was huge. The steering wheel was like it had come off a truck. It was so big. Gear lever had the biggest handle on it that you could ever think of. Because, you know, you're coming back to an era where you were doing, 35 gear changes a lap, and they were getting huge blisters on their hands. So therefore, there was a big gear lever on it and a steering wheel because there was no power steering. It was literally physically lumping this thing around. And so, you know, you just sit in the car and everything is perfect, no question. But it was just a very different environment for the driver. Two buttons on the steering wheel. One was a drinks button and one was to change. There was a page on a little display and it was to change the display from like one line item to another. And so, you know, very, very limited. And then when you came into the pits, they would print out two pieces of paper and hold them up to the light type of thing. It was, you know, you couldn't overlay graphs looking at computers or anything else. It was literally a printout and then trying to check it from visuals between one driver and the other. But what I remember was the first few laps, thinking this thing's got no grunt.
Got no grunt.
Zero grunt. I was coming out of the hairpins in Estoril. So you come through the first corner, which is a fourth gear right-hander, down from six gears, down into fourth, fifth gear flat into the next one, then down into second, then up the hill, down second for the next left hairpin, and then onto the back straight. But I'm thinking, this has got no grunt. And then on the second lap, I realised I'd gone round the hairpins in fourth gear, not second. And then I hit second and it took off. It literally took off. I was like in a rocket ship going, Jesus.
This was the V10, wasn't
it? This was the V10. But it was the most tractable engine I think I've ever driven. So
can you just describe what you mean by that?
Well, I could drive through in second gear and it would scream its head off. Or I could drive through in fourth and it would still have the torque to pull you out of the corner. So you could, and this was one of, again, thinking back, you've got a manual gear shift here. So you don't and cannot be changing gear in the middle of corners like you can now with paddle shift. Because you physically had one hand on the wheel holding on to this bucking Bronco with no power steering and your other hand. So it was just much more difficult. Also going across the gate. So it was quite easy then to snick third gear when you were meaning to go into fifth, for example. And so in that respect, people tended to shift more in a straight line than they would in corners as you do nowadays. And so with regard to that side of it, you were, I would say, more straight turn and go. And when you had the torque, then you could then maybe go in a higher gear and then just focus on keeping the balance of the car correct, as opposed to necessarily having to get into the right gear to get the power delivery. And that's where I think that V10 was super, super good.
While we're talking gears, I read something and I want to know whether it's true. Did you not heel and toe back then?
No.
Is that so? It is true.
So it is true.
So what, you just ripped it through the gears without blipping the throttle?
Yeah, I wasn't actually. I've got the dog ring, the second gear dog ring from that test, because I said to you I went around the hairpin in fourth, and there was no one to tell me I was going around the hairpin in fourth. There wasn't, you know, there was pit to car radio, but they didn't know what the hell was going on because there was no data. But yeah, I've still got the dog ring from it as well, because as a reminder, you need to heel and toe. So after that test, I then through that winter learned to heel and toe in a road car. So I'd done Formula Ford, Vauxhall Lotus and F3.
With huge success, I might add.
Yeah.
Without
heel and toe. So I used to brake.
And what, just lock the rears every time?
And just crash it down through the box. I wondered why I'd always a lot of front brake balance. Maybe I know now. But it was a skill set that, I have to be honest with you, wasn't my forte. It was heeling and towing. And so I found another way around it. Now, it didn't hamper me too much. It only when I got into very high-powered cars, like Formula 3000 at the time, and also an F1 car, that actually it was a negative. And so then I had to sort of learn how to do it. And as I said, through the winter on the roads of southern Scotland, I was learning to heel and toe.
And while we're talking driving style, you've already said you had Ayrton Senna in the next door garage. What did you make of his blipping of the throttle? Did you try it?
Yeah, it was a bit of an era thing. You know, it's not needed now because you've got instant response. But at that time...
Did you need it with the V10, though?
You still needed it because it also kept the car alive. You know, cars had a lot less grip than today. And so you had to make them move around a little bit. And that was his way of doing it. There was a lot of corners as well where you probably, and a lot of drivers would do it without necessarily thinking. Estoril, for example, at the end of the back straight, there was a second gear accelerating faster exit, but you couldn't plant the throttle. So you needed to sort of stab into the throttle at different points to get the car to move and to also pull out of the corner. So I don't think it was just him. I know there's a lot made about it. I don't think it was just him, but he definitely accentuated it. And his style came from the turbo, from basically 88, more than necessarily than normally aspirated in 89 or 90. But it was something that I think he had attuned to make work for him, and others were doing it, but not necessarily in the same sort of scope.
And how interested was Ayrton in your testing?
Like I said, you just jump in and you go and you do it. You don't think too much about it. But looking back, he was interested in what the feelings were. I remember, though, because then the first test of the V12 was at Silverstone the following year at the pre-Grand Prix test. And I drove, and then Ayrton was very interested in what the V12 was going to be like, because it was clearly coming for the following season for 91. And so, you know, doing the test, super interested in what was going on there. But then when he got into the car, and this was a bit of a mind shift for me, when he drove, he was talking about friction and various different things, and I was thinking, this is bloody quick. But he was actually going into a lot more detail, and that was where I realized, actually, if you want to be in this sport and at the level, then you've got to put in so much more effort and work that's off the circuit, on the circuit, engineering, everything else. And it came from just his level of feedback and his ability to remember a race run and deliver it back on lap 5, this, on lap 7, this happened, that corner here, everywhere else. Again, because there was such limited data. So the driver was downloading the data and repeating it back to the engineers.
And what did he mean by friction?
Engine friction.
So like piston friction?
Yeah, just basically the piston going up and down the cylinder, it didn't feel like it was running free. You know, it felt like...
He could feel that.
Well, I couldn't. He could. I could feel 650 horsepower and going down the straight like hell. But yeah, he could feel it because, he was much more attuned to it than I was. And so, you know, that side of it was an area that you see experience. That was a point of experience. Clearly, the guy was super good, but it was a point of experience as well.
Tell us about your journey with McLaren then, from that first test at Estoril. When did Ron Dennis sign you up properly?
Before the first test. So it was before the British Grand Prix F3 support race. So I think we signed on the Tuesday prior to the British Grand Prix in 1989. And
as a what?
As test reserve. And so then I was doing the test at the end of the year, and it was subject to good test. Which was the Formula One test in Estoril. And then really it kicked off in 1990.
And how much mileage were you doing?
I was in Suzuka for 3 days every month through predominantly 1991.
Doing what?
V12. V12 testing.
Pounding round Suzuka.
So you do 2 days of testing and then race run on the third day. So, you know, the last thing you did was a blooming 52-lap race run. It's like, brilliant. Suzuka, one of the hardest circuits at the time as well. But, you know, a lot of running there. There was running in Estoril through the winter. There's a lot in the winter in Estoril, which was a test circuit that pretty much everybody went to. Barcelona wasn't open at this point, we've got to remember. And then as well, other ones dotted around about Europe, but predominantly the same sort of circuit.
So the trips to Japan were for Honda.
They were all for the V12, yeah.
Tell us how different was the engine from one test to the next. What was the rate of development?
There was two rates of development really at that time. One of them was on fuel and the other one was on the engine. So the engine was stepping forward. A lot of it was on revs, you know, because you were trying to, with a V12, you needed to have a higher rev basically to get the power out. And so there was a lot of development onto that. Pneumatic valves were coming in, that sort of thing. And the other one was on fuels, because I don't know if you remember, Tom, because you're quite young, but there was quite exotic fuel brews going around at the time.
I remember Avgas. I remember walking into one of the garages.
Don't you? And not the group.
I'm not going to say which team, but I remember walking into a garage at that time and my eyes were watering.
Yeah. So there was a lot of development in that and trying to, you know, get the right power fuel that didn't melt the engines, basically. And so
it's funny, isn't it, how history repeats itself? Because here we are next year. One of the big changes in 26 is the sustainable fuels.
And it is. And it, you know, at the end of the day, it's where technology allows you to go. And so, you know, you break down a barrier in one section and it suddenly opens up a new avenue to explore and to develop. Back then, it was a very different type of fuel, I've got to be honest with you. But I think we all remember those days.
So you're doing a lot of mileage, but a lot of it is in Japan, out of the limelight.
Yeah, so predominantly,
so in a funny kind of way, did it stall your career being McLaren's test driver?
No, I would say not. It was not in the limelight, but there was no test drivers in the limelight because there was not really very many test drivers because race drivers did all the testing. And so in that respect, it wasn't as it, like it was latterly, where you've got development reserve drivers for each team, etc., and it's a profile point. It was gaining experience without question with one of the best teams, with some of the best engineering brains of the era around and about. But at the same time, I was racing in Formula 3000, which was, from my point of view, the main point. What I was doing was racing, not testing. And so through 1991, 92, I was racing in Formula 3000, and that was the current Formula 2. And so, you know, my point was to deliver on that. And the Formula 1 side of things was maybe a distraction at times, if I'm honest with you, because you were jumping from one thing, and they're very different beasts, one thing on one side of the world back into something over here. But it was something at the time, you get the opportunity. You're not going to say no. You're not going to turn it down, are you?
Well, Alan, except. Dario Franchitti was on the show earlier this year, and Ron Dennis, same person, offered him, I think, a very lucrative 7-year test contract in which he could still race in IndyCar, and then he would get Concorde back to Europe and do tests for 3 days and then go back to do an IndyCar race. And Dario turned that down because I think the word distraction is probably quite a good one.
Well, Dario, I've known since I was 13 years old. 14 in and around there, very, very well. So he actually saw, I would say, up close and personal, my whole career. And very much so. He was there, not necessarily on the front line, if you like, but he was there through all of that era. So he knew the pitfalls of it by then. And he also, remember, saw Michael Andretti doing that Concorde back and forward. And, you know, how difficult it was, you know, and on a piece of paper, I think all these things work out. But in practicality, they are sometimes got a few difficulties.
So the trips to Japan and the subsequent jet lag, did that affect your performances in F3000?
Yes, it did. I have to be honest, it did. So I remember coming back from a Japanese test straight to Le Mans and over the date line, going Tokyo to Alaska, Alaska, Paris, Paris to Le Mans, straight into the car. And there is no question I was not at my best. Still running second in the race, but I could have been winning the race. So what is the delta? You could never really say, but it wasn't the ideal preparation every time. I'm not saying that anyone's fault. Now, you know, I've got to put my hand up at different points as well. But again, I come back though, when that's sitting there on the table, yeah, I don't think you turn them down very easily.
This show is sponsored by Liquid IV. How are you handling the shift into autumn? After slow summer days and a break from your usual routines, it can take a minute to find your rhythm again. One day you're in full holiday mode, the next your calendar's packed, the pace has picked up, and as those darker nights creep in, your energy starts to dip. If your energy's been flagging lately, Liquid IV's new sugar-free energy multiplier might be exactly what you need to get back into top gear. Powered by Live Hydroscience, this sugar-free hydration booster combines an optimized blend of electrolytes, vitamins, and natural caffeine. Just one stick mixed in 16 ounces of water delivers balanced energy that lasts, without the sugar crash or jittery side effects that come with most energy drinks. You'll feel sharper, more focused, and better equipped to take on whatever the day throws at you. Whether you need a little lift before tackling the school run, your daily workout, or just to avoid the dreaded afternoon slump, don't let the grind drain you. Ditch the glitch with zero sugar and zero crash from Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with the code GRID at checkout. That's 20% off your first order with the code GRID at liquidiv.com. This episode is sponsored by Car Gurus. Buying a car is a big decision for anyone, but it can sometimes feel like a bit of a guessing game. Is this actually a good price? Should I wait? Am I missing something? When I was looking for our family car, I must have refreshed the same three sites 100 times. One was too small, one had no service history, and a couple sold before I'd even finished reading the listing. And I wasted so much time driving around to different dealerships chasing a decent deal. Next time I'm on the hunt, I'll turn to Car Gurus, because they put all the information you need right at your fingertips, from complete car specs and owner history to price changes and dealer reviews, so you're never left second guessing. You can search, buy and sell all in one place, and with access to hundreds of thousands of cars from top-rated dealers across the UK, it's easy to compare your options and find something that ticks all the right boxes. What I really like is how they break down the deal ratings. CarGurus is the only site in the UK that shows every listing, from great to overpriced, so you know exactly where you stand from the start. If you're anything like me, having that kind of transparency gives you the confidence to make a choice you'll feel good about. So join the millions who've already found their best deal with CarGurus. Go to cargurus.co.uk for complete vehicle details without any surprises. That's cargurus.co.uk. Cargurus.co.uk. CarGurus. Search, buy, sell, sorted. When do you think you were at your peak as a racing driver?
In what category?
I don't think it's category specific, but
I think it is.
I feel, because we're going to talk about Toyota in due course when you got your break in Formula One, but I think that came too late for you.
Yeah, definitely, 100%.
So when were you at your peak? In the mid-90s?
I would say at my peak with pure experience of life and everything else was probably when I was maybe 33, 34, which was because I had seen so much and worked with so many people. You know, I had a very, very wide overview of all areas. But it probably at my peak to jump into Formula One, when you're talking about that, without, you know, other things going on, I would say when I was maybe 21.
As young as that?
Yeah. And unfortunately, when I was 21, I was ill. And I had a virus, which I went to see Sid Watkins. You remember Prof? I went to see Prof and he basically said, look, 6 months it'll go, but that's what it is. And I really had a difficult year. And that knocked a lot of the momentum out of my career. And there was a few sort of knocks on the road, but that one really did, I would say, take the momentum out of it.
So you're 21, what is that, 1990, 1991?
End of 91, beginning of 92.
And that was when you were doing this ridiculous amount of travelling. Do you think the virus was brought on by the travel?
No, I think the virus was brought on by a mouthful of rice in Thailand, believe it or not. I was ill from that moment afterwards, and I just didn't recover. I was just had no energy. My joints were swollen up. I couldn't put pressure onto the pedal. I had to be lifted out of the car in Hockenheim after finishing second in 3000 because my right and left, the ball of my foot was like a big balloon blister, but so sensitive and sore that I couldn't put the pressure on the brake pedal. So, you know, there's a whole load of things going on there, and you just kind of get on and do them because what else are you going to do? We're not talking about the medical treatment and support mechanisms that you have today. We're talking about a very different era there. And so, you know, you just get on and muscle on with it. But I think looking back, the spotlight, because you said coming man, everything else, the spotlight and the momentum went in that era, in that point.
Because how long does a driver get in that spotlight where you're the coming guy? And if you don't take advantage of that, you're gone.
I think a year. I think they're naturally, because, you know, we're goldfish. We swim around, and by the time we get back round to the end of the lap, we're forgotten again.
Well, isn't it interesting? Because actually, a guy you raced with a lot in the junior formulas, you were both on the Philip Morris Young Driver program, I suppose we could refer to it as, Mika Häkkinen I'm talking about, he kind of inherited your position.
Yeah, so Mika
as the coming guy, right?
So in 89, we were both doing Formula 3, and he had a really difficult year. He struggled. And the spotlight went from Mika, because Mika was always has been brilliant. You know, super quick, very, very natural, very quick to get up to speed. And not always completely understanding why he was quick, but it didn't matter because he was always quick. And in F3, he had a really difficult year, had to repeat the season. I went on to Formula 3000. And then he got an option to run in the Lotus, which was back of the grid team, but did a stunning job in it. And once he was in Formula 1, then he accelerated on from there.
And he actually inherited your McLaren test role.
He did. So basically in 93, he then was testing at McLaren and jumped in and raced. And then in Estoril did the stunning job by qualifying Senna.
In his first race for the team?
In his first race.
How nuts
is that? My God. But Mika would do that, come in and not think very much about it. You know, because he just did, as opposed to think he just did it. And so, yes, you're right. But I think you've got a year, roughly, where the spotlight's on you. And then after that, then you need to work pretty hard at it.
Can we just talk about two more drivers before we move on to you going to Toyota at McLaren? Alain Prost, you were his test driver as well as Ayrton Senna's test driver.
Not 100%. I kind of was, because the first overall I had was actually one of Prost's, believe it or not, and the seat. So when
are you the same height?
I did that test in Estoril, and it wasn't a time when you then got measured and laser scanned for overalls and things like that. And so it's a case of, well, Prost's overall's there. So I had Prost overall, believe it or not.
Well, and then he then went to Ferrari.
And then he went to Ferrari.
Yeah. But were you ever alongside him at a test? You weren't?
No, I was never alongside him at a test. But without doubt, he had such a, I would say, an influence of that era. Where I saw Alan was before, when you were saying about the Marlboro World Championship team, the Young Driver Project. You know, we went to various events and he was at McLaren at the time. Also when he was at Ferrari afterwards, because they were still involved. And so we got to sort of, as a young driver, see them, understand them a little bit and got to know him, but never actually in the same car.
Did you ever have a technical conversation with him? You know,
I'm sure it was technical for me. I'm sure it wasn't technical for him.
Well, what about Gerhard Berger then? Because you really were working with
Gerhard. Yes, with Gerhard, yes.
I've always felt that Gerhard hasn't always had the respect he deserves, because he was a bloody good racing driver, but because he was alongside Senna, he didn't always come out smelling of roses. Was he better than his reputation and the 10 Grand Prix wins?
Yeah,
have
I think
you believe?
Gerhard was very, very good. It's funny, a picture came up on Instagram from his win at Benetton in Hockenheim.
97.
Remember? In 97. Yeah. And it just reminded me, actually, he had a long career where he was winning a lot of the way through it. And I remember the first time really seeing Gerhard and thinking about, Christ, he's quick, I'm going to have to work here, was Stowe, when they reprofiled Silverstone and we were testing there, and Stowe was different to what it is today. You would go in and it was still a bit bumpy going in, but then it tightened and had a kind of fastest chicane on the exit. And coming through there, it was fourth gear, and he chucked it through there. Really was quick in that high speed stuff. And that was one where I thought, ooh, you know, he's got something about him.
Brave as a lion.
Yeah, he definitely stuck it in. And Gerhard, I think, was in the right car, but unfortunately with a teammate that was pretty exceptional.
But I remember, a bit like Hakkinen coming in and showing Senna the way at Estoril in 93, I remember Berger out-qualifying Senna in Phoenix year in 90.
And yep.
As he said to me once, he said, I never saw him again, but I did out-qualify him the first time.
Yeah, but where Gerhard, you know, you look at Gerhard's career, and it's not all about 10 Grand Prix wins. If you think about it, he was very clever in the way that he structured his career. He's very clever in the way that he's done his post-racing career as well, as in driving career. And I think there was a lot of things going on there, and he was quite strategic in the way that he planned things. Maybe not necessarily always with the sort of thought process at the time of X, Y, Z, these steps, but actually looking back, it was a very strategic career.
He was a party boy, though. I think that doesn't help his reputation either.
Yeah, I don't know. In the era, I think it probably, with some teams, probably did. Remember, we're talking, James Hunt was still commentating there. You talk about the ultimate party boy. Lord Hesketh was the chairman of the BRDC or the president of the BRDC. So there was a few party boys in the paddock.
Actually, Alan, you mentioned James Hunt. He was part of the Marlborough World Championship team selection process, wasn't he?
Oh, so he was also advisor. James was there through the majority of my...
Did he advise you?
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of times I had lovely conversations with James at his house or circuits and things. But the one that stands out was we were going to Nürburgring. And I phoned him up and said, James, going to Nürburgring. And it was when the new circuit had just been done. He went, yes, McHaggis. He always called me McHaggis. Not sure if he remember my real name, but he called me McHaggis, and he said, McHaggis, he says, yeah, rubbish. It's a rubbish circuit. The old track, and he gave me chapter and verse. I said, yeah, but James, I'm racing on the new one. And he went, yeah, but it's complete rubbish. And he just kept telling me about the old circuit. It was fantastic. But there was a few things I used to, when I was younger, one thing, I would lead a race and I would go off into the lead. And then I would make a little mistake, a stupid little mistake, because I would look at the pit board and see plus 3 seconds or whatever. 10 laps to go and outbreak myself and lose a second or whatever it was. And I said this to him. He said, well, why do you look at the pit board? Just stop looking at the pit board. Which was so obvious, but I hadn't ever thought of it, because what do you do every lap when the pit board's there? You look at it. That then started making me think, how does my brain work? And how can I then make sure that I don't make stupid mistakes like that by just creating the atmosphere where I lose concentration? And so James, you know, was there for a lot of my junior career, and there was a few nuggets, absolute beautiful nuggets that he delivered that I used all the way through my career, as it turned out. Never looked at pit boards very often after that.
Well, isn't it? And we've got 50 years of his world championship coming up next season. Let's bring it on to Toyota now. You get your big break in 2002, but the Formula One bit of your Toyota relationship starts a year earlier.
Yep.
A huge testing program. How different was the testing work with Toyota to what you'd been doing with McLaren?
The actual Toyota started before that, a year before. So I was racing with Porsche at Le Mans, and we won Le Mans in 98. And Porsche then at the end of the year announced that they were pulling out of the project. And so I was sitting there thinking, ooh, what am I going to do now? And had a meeting at Toyota with Ove Andersen at the time. And Ove said, yep, we want to put you in the car. You'll be with Thierry Boutsen and Ralph Kellenhers. And Thierry will qualify. He will start the race. You'll be second. Ralph will be there. And that was it. It was like super clear from the December the year before how the race was going to progress. And the Toyota was quick that year, because we were battling out in 98 between Porsche and Toyota for winning the 24 hours. And so I thought, yep, pretty good place to go. But at that time, I didn't even know they were looking at Formula One. And so at the end of it, 1 week after the race, my contract with Toyota finished. I continued with Porsche developing a car for the 2000 season, which ultimately was a stillborn car. They had tested it once and never raced. And at the end of the year, Ove, well, in fact, it was in 2000, January 2000, Ovi phoned up and said, are you interested in Formula One? And so I flew to Cologne, sat down with him, and he explained about the Formula One project and how they wanted to do some testing, preliminary testing in 2000 at the end of the year with the GT1, which was a sports car, hydraulics and things like that, just a couple of tests, and then a full testing program with a complete F1 mule car in 2001 and racing in 2002. And I sort of sat there and thought, biggest car manufacturer in the world, they're clearly going to attack it, and you know, they definitely had the money to do it. And so that was where I would say the first conversation was in his office, I think it was middle of January in 2000.
And then when did you first test the F1 car?
The first test of the F1 car was actually of the mule car, was at Paul Ricard after the launch. You remember the launch where they took over Ricard Circuit, and Ricard was reprofiled at that time. And then that was the first test.
The great and the good of Formula One were there. I remember Bernie being, Bernie Ecclestone.
Well, he owned the circuit. It was his track we were borrowing.
But I remember Max Mosley being there as well. All the big guns from Formula One at the time were there. And then in 2001, just describe the scale of what was only a test program. You were going all over the world, weren't you?
Yeah, we did. We didn't go to all the circuits, but we went to the majority of circuits. There were 16 Grand Prix at the time. You know, we travelled far and wide, we did European races. And at certain ones, like we did a full simulation in Austria from arriving on the Thursday to where your meetings would be, track walk, Friday, FP1, FP2, qualifying exactly at the times as it would go through. And then the race, simulated race as well, with two cars, Mika and I, Mika Salo, that is. So we did that there, but we also went to Malaysia, did 2-3 days of testing, Imola, quite a few Grand Prix circuits, with a complete team. And it was to try and build the team up as much as anything else, and also to get a bit of reliability onto some of the, you know, power units, one part of it, but also hydraulics, gearboxes, and that sort of thing. And then we had the first test of the actual race car very, very early. And that was in November of 2001 at Ricard, in a very, very cold 15-day, I think it was, test at Ricard. It was an insane amount of testing, because testing was unlimited. So you just could run as much as you wanted. And we were very prepared by the time we got to the first race for reliability, which was probably the one asset that they had, was that actually that the car was reliable from the beginning of the season.
I was going to say, how ready were you? And I remember Salo, that first race of 2002, Mika was dicing with Mark Webber in the Minardi.
How ready were we as a team? Not very, in reality. As a wider team, not very. When I say that, being able to race a car, develop that car, again, because you could develop it through the season in any way whatsoever, and also then prepare and design a new car for the following season. That was where I think the team struggled quite a bit, was taking that, you know, three parallel workloads on. As a group as well, there was a lot of inexperience in it. On my side of the garage, we had no one that really had experience on the engineering side or on myself of racing in an F1 car. And on Mika's side, there was Mika and Humphrey Corbett, you remember?
Of course.
Humphrey and Humph. And, you know, so therefore I would say across the board, there was a lot of inexperience there and learning, but actually a team that stuck together pretty well and learned. And I think, you know, if I look back now, they were a fantastic university for a lot of very good people that went on to other things in motorsport. Just unfortunately for Toyota, it didn't work out for them, you know, in terms of the success that they had hoped for, certainly the first year.
Why didn't it work for Toyota? They had the money, they had the facilities. The wind tunnel that they built in Cologne is the one being used by the Cadillac Formula One team now. It felt like they had everything.
There's a big difference between having everything and having a team. It's not an easy world, this, is it? We've seen a lot of teams come and go that haven't quite had the success, but Toyota probably, in terms of investment, well, it was the one thing that they missed off their trophy cabinet, and a very tough one, but they threw everything at it and probably pulled out due to the global financial crisis, we have to remember, when I think a lot of manufacturers had to stop their racing programs, but probably stopped a little bit too early.
Kamui Kobayashi came on the show a couple of years back, and he said that that car at the end of 08 was actually a decent one, and the car they had in the wind tunnel for 09, of course, was going to be mega, but of course we never...
Yeah, you know, was it going to beat the Braun? You never know. But coming back, I think one thing was that, you know, you need to have a racing team mentality. And that was part of the growing process, I think, of the team, was that it was very structured. And maybe Ovi had that racing team mentality, but when he stepped aside, slowed down, retired, then it became quite formal, I think, there, which then lost a little bit of that sort of drive that it had. I think it came back a little bit later on in the process, but certainly in the first two or three years, 2002, 3, 4, it didn't have that.
How do you reflect on your season, 2002?
Frustrated.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I can imagine.
Frustrated, you know, in terms of that, I look at it, you know, the first race, Ralph had the big flying incident at the first corner in Melbourne, so, you know, 7 or 8 cars out, I was in the middle of that, running 6th, and there was points only to 6th. In Malaysia, came in and there was a mess up at the pit stop. They took my old tyres off and put them back on again. And so did the last stint with already 20 lap tyres around Malaysia.
But you finished 7th, right? Yeah. Which with today's scoring system, you would have actually had 4 points finishes that year with today's scoring system.
Yeah, so, you know, in that respect, I think the biggest frustration for me was probably Monza, where running 6th or 7th at the time and the front suspension failed because of an engineering issue. And I was sitting right behind Eddie Irvine in the Jag, actually, and Eddie went on to finish 3rd. I'm not saying I'd have finished 4th, but that one was probably the most frustrating because I knew by then that was our last real chance of points before the end of the season. And that one bit a little bit, if I'm very honest with you, because it was, we're running really well round there. The car was a tricky car. It didn't really develop through the course of the season with as everybody else did, which was part of the, what I said to you, that one of the hurdles they found difficult was actually developing the current car whilst racing it, whilst developing the 2003 car as well. And, you know, that triple line of work was an area that on the race team side of things, you know, was a bit frustrating as well. But again, I come back, I learned a hell of a lot. Really did. When I came out of it, I was a much better driver, much stronger in mentally, because, you know, you get beaten around a little bit there, honestly. And also in terms of understanding what you needed to do, what I needed to do, how I needed to control my environment more. And then in everything I did from there, I used all of the experience of that in and out of the car without question. And so I think as much as it was a rough ride at times, it was actually a very important ride for my career in other ways.
Do you think you and Mika were made scapegoats for what was a disappointing season? Because I think Toyota took the unusual step of replacing both of you at the end of the year.
Yeah, they did. Scapegoats, it's their prerogative. Teams, they hire who they want to hire. That's the reality. I don't, you know, think of it in that way. I put it a different way. I think with what we had, we did a pretty reasonable job. Yeah, I'm sure there's areas where we could have done better, but the circumstances, everything else, I think we did a, you know, pretty reasonable job. And at the end, they wanted to have a change, and they had a change. They had a change of a lot of personnel through the course of it as well.
This episode is sponsored by Vanta. Anyone in the world of business will know that the bigger your business gets, the messier security and compliance can become. And when customers are trusting you with their data, "we'll deal with it later" doesn't really cut it. That's where Vanta can help. Vanta helps businesses get compliant fast and stay that way by automating all the tricky, time-consuming bits and keeping everything up to date with continuous monitoring. It works quietly in the background so you can focus on running your company while it handles compliance for frameworks like SOC 2, ISO 27001 to HIPAA and more. I like how it brings everything into one place, your risk assessments, your controls, even your audit process, so you're not scrabbling when questions come up. And whether you're a growing startup like Cursor or a big player like Snowflake, Vanta scales with you and makes sure trust is something you show, not just say. Get started at vanta.com/grid. That's VANTA.com/grid. You came back to Formula One the following year with Renault.
Oh, yeah.
As their, what do we call it? Were you the third driver, the reserve driver? Or
well, both? It was a different time because that was the first time when you had a third car running on Fridays. So
it was like a Friday World Championship. I remember seeing you and Anthony Davidson, Alex Wirtz, all the, it was
brilliant.
It made Fridays more interesting. I'll definitely tell you that.
It was. That was actually a very critical point in my career. Because the first test I did in the Renault was in Barcelona. And my first flying lap in a new car, new team, was quicker than my qualifying lap in the Toyota the year before. So I had 60 kilos of fuel out the pits, first line lap, quicker than zero fuel qualifying laps the year before. Which showed me the difference between a team that was fighting at the front and a team that was fighting, if you like. And it just reminded me, why are you here? What is the principle that you are racing? Are you racing to be competitive, to be successful and win? Or are you just racing to be in the game? And for me, it was a very clear point that if you're going to be in it, you've got to be in it with the right people and the right group to actually be successful. Otherwise, you're going to be frustrated. And that was a very personal thing. So I ran every Friday. And also, there was a limit of 20 test days as well. So we'd go testing. I did all the 20 test days. Fernando and Jarno Trulli and Fernando Alonso were the two race drivers. And I was a reserve driver. And that was the job. So it was quite interesting because I did all the tyre development. And then on the Friday at lunchtime or Friday afternoon, sit down with Pat Simmons and then decide which tyre we would then use for the Saturday and the Sunday. Because you then had options, and it was a tyre war, Bridgestone Michelin. So you had options of going for different specs, even on the Friday, for use on the Saturday. And so all of this, it was brilliant time, I've got to be honest with you.
And you felt properly involved in the race weekend.
Completely involved in the race weekend from start to finish. In a way that I think would be very difficult now, because you were actively involved on the Friday. You were there live making strategic decisions on some changes and developments that, you know, had a direct impact on the Saturday morning.
So you were working with a very young Fernando Alonso, and it was 2003 that he won his first race.
Budapest.
In Budapest, exactly. Same breath as Senna? How good is Fernando?
Fernando is pretty sensational. And the thing that impressed me about Fernando was he was sitting in the Formula One car. He was in the race seat, but he was as interested what I was talking about from the Friday morning than if it had been him driving it. So he was absorbing every bit of information from everybody. It didn't matter who they were. And it was without doubt he was going to win that race in Budapest. It was pretty clear. The fuel load he had on, everything else, I don't think there was any question of anyone coming close to him that particular day. And ultimately he won his first race and it wasn't to be his last.
And if there's one quality that stood out and probably still stands out today about Fernando Alonso, what would that be?
For me, it's his ability just to drive a result out of something. You know, he had a very different driving technique. We talked about Senna and pumping the throttle. Fernando as well, because it was groove tyres at that time. And you had to try to balance the slip angle of the front tyre on the edge of where the grip was. And he would just shoot straight over the top of it. He would turn in as if he was turning 20% more lock than anyone else and go over the edge of the tyre. But he had a way of understanding what the tyre was delivering back to him and to keep the grip. And he could just metronomically keep pushing at such a high level for such a long period of time. And that sort of that ability, I think, was one and still is one of his strengths.
Didn't he just have endless understeer?
No, I did when I tried it, but he didn't. He was able to make that style work for him. Other people tried it, didn't quite work out for him, but he was able to do it. He just overslipped the front quite a lot. It worked very much. It was maybe a Michelin thing as well. If he had put on a Bridgestone, maybe it didn't work with that. But certainly with the Michelins, he could get that dynamic to work.
And for you, the Renault third driver was just that one season. Was there talk of doing more with them?
Yeah, there was. But I didn't race that year. And I wanted to get back to racing. I said to you there, it reminded me, why are you in the sport? Are you in it just to be in it? Or are you in it to do something? And I wanted to get back to racing. And there was an opportunity of maybe something in F1, but it was not really going to happen, in all honesty. And Dr. Ulrich, the handshake, we always kept in touch. And he said, look, we've got this project coming along, which was going to originally start in 2005. It was pushed to 2006. We'd like you to be involved. And then I went back to Ingolstadt and my term at Audi. So this is actually...
We've gone full circle.
Yeah, it's gone full circle, but it's 25 years since I first agreed to drive for Audi. I'm back in, you know, for the 2000 season. We're now in 2025. And so it's full circle. Yeah.
Alan, why were you such a brilliant sports car driver? Don't be modest.
I think I was very lucky in my junior career. I worked with a lot of very good people. When I talk about, you know, you mentioned Ayrton Senna there, or Gerhard Berger, or Michael Schumacher at Benetton in 93, or Fernando and Jarno at Renault later on. But as well, you know, a Ross Brawn or a Pat Simmons and people like that, you drain a lot of experience out of them. So I understood you had to really push to deliver. The second part was I was at an era of change in sports car racing where you weren't necessarily conserving gearboxes. We talked about healing and towing. Thankfully, those days were gone out of sports car racing, or I think I would have got to hour one of Le Mans as opposed to hour 24. But the cars were much more reliable and you could push them hard for a long period of time. But the other thing was, I think I was good at overtaking. And that comes back to when I started karting, you would have like a lottery of grids for your heats. And so you'd have one heat at the front, one in the middle, one at the back. And the accumulation result of the three would give you your grid for the final. So it wasn't a timed qualifying. It was actually a qualifying through race results. And if you weren't very good at overtaking, your race at the back, you would just be nowhere. So you learn to overtake. And I was pretty good at that. And in sports car racing, you've got to do a lot more overtaking than any other category. And so it was one that fitted for me at the right time of experience, at the right time of, I would say, the technical development. And it fitted for my skill set of being able to sort of see through traffic.
Alan, this reminds me of 2011. It was the first time I went to Le Mans.
Oh, yeah.
And I was actually very nervous for a while because you were taken out by a backmarker whilst overtaking.
I wouldn't say taken out by a backmarker, in all transparency. It was quite early on in the race and coming through Dunlop chicane, down through the S's. And I'd actually just taken the lead of the race. My teammate had run wide at Dunlop and I'd slipped past him and I was giving him a gap on the left-hand side. As I then looped into the right-hander of the S's, there was a Ferrari came in and touched. And I had never seen the Ferrari at all. The Ferrari was completely invisible to me until, to be honest with you, until I was in the hospital and I'd asked our team doctor what had happened. Because I knew I'd touched something, but I didn't know, and gone off backwards into the barrier, big barrel roll, all the other bits and pieces, bumped my head. And so I can't necessarily attribute it to being taken out. I think two cars didn't see each other and two cars don't go into one very often. But it was a big reminder that anything at Le Mans is quick. And that year we had our other sister car with Mike Rockenfeller, had a huge monster shunt as well in the middle of the night with a Ferrari in a very similar circumstance at the back of the circuit. But thankfully, the third car won.
Now, let's fast forward to 2013.
Yeah.
You do a Nico Rosberg. You win the world championship and then cool time on your career. Why such an abrupt ending?
I realised I wasn't getting any younger. I realised that age was always going to slow me down. I never wanted to be the weak link in a chain, and I was enjoying it less and less. So all of the things sort of combined. I remember doing, we raced in Spa as a pre-Le Mans race, and we were leading pole position, technical issue with the floor of the car, and just with the post-race briefing, I thought, wow, I'm pushing water uphill a little bit here.
Yeah, but don't we all have days like that
at work? We do, but yeah. Then won Le Mans, won in Austin, which then set us up to win the World Championship. And on the drive back to Houston, I was actually with a journalist on a media drive, and I was sitting in this RS5 going to a little German town that's quite near Austin for a lunch and then driving down to Houston. And I suddenly thought, no, end of the year, that's it. it was just there and then, the whole thing accumulated in my head that that was going to be it. Didn't tell anybody. Won the championship in China. Flew home. Actually flew to Paris. We made the film for the FIA, which was for the Grand Gala. And then I flew home, told my wife, Kelly, that that was it. She sort of looked at me and said, are you sure? And I said, yep. She said, you're not going to be staying at home, are you? That was her first comment, which was a bit worrying. I then went to Ingolstadt, spoke to Dr. Ulrich and Dieter Gass, who were running the projects at the time. And Dr. Ulrich, in his way, because I'd obviously known him for a long time, put his hand on my shoulder and said, are you sure? I said, I'm sure. He said, come back in 2 weeks and tell me if you're sure. Went home, came back in 2 weeks, said, no, I'm sure. That's it. And so then we had the end of gala awards, announced it there, and that was it. Done. Sat in a racing car once since then.
Can I just break this decision down? Mm-hmm. Your results in 2013 would suggest that you hadn't slowed down. You said you didn't want to be the dead weight in the car and things. There was no evidence that that was the case.
No. I'd put so much energy into that year that I think as well, you know, you've got to remember I'd raced for 32 years. I'd been effectively my life 365 since I was 17. I was 43. You know, my tank had run down a little bit. I could see the reserve light coming on in my energy levels. You know, I was never going to get any quicker. I was only going to get slower. I was only going to then have to work harder and harder to achieve the same. And it was never going to achieve a new goal, because that year we won the World Championship, we won Le Mans. And also the other thing is, winning the World Championship was a very personal thing, because I lost that in 1985 at Le Mans, as it turned out, in the karting World Championship to Andrea Gilardi. Second was Michael Schumacher. And I should have won that day. And I was so bitterly disappointed with that, that I didn't make the jump into the first corner and lead into the first corner. I was pushed into third at the first corner. That it took, when we won the championship, then that was the final tick in the box. And I think for me personally, then that just was the sort of full circle part of it as well.
And you said that you weren't enjoying it as much.
Yep.
What bit of being a racing driver did you enjoy the most?
I really enjoyed qualifying at the end, because that was your ultimate, just lifting the car up and getting maximum out of it. And the other thing that I very much enjoyed was, you hear that podium ceremony maybe in the background, you hear the podium music, they're practicing here, was hearing that. And it was all about winning. So it wasn't about the competition. I lost the enjoyment for all of the testing. I lost the enjoyment for all of the work behind the scenes, you know, the pushing to the absolute limits of all of those areas. I lost the enjoyment of everything apart from that qualifying lap and standing on that podium. And everything in between was a means to get to those points. And that's where my energy level had just dropped out. And it was, I needed a refresh. And I wasn't going to get it by doing the same thing again. And so I needed a next challenge. And you always do that. So it was a change of the chapter of the book.
And how do you enjoy being a member of the Audi Formula One team, but not as a driver?
Loving it. Absolutely love it. Because as a driver, you see such a narrow view of the sport. You see such a narrow view of a team. You don't see the full structure behind it. You don't see the effort that everybody else puts into it. You don't understand the intricacies of it.
Can I interrupt you there? Yeah. Do you not think the good ones do see that?
Not to the extent. I don't think to the extent.
Michael Schumacher famously knew everyone's name.
Yep, but I don't know if he understood what everybody did to ensure that everything was there ready for him to deliver. And it's the depth of work behind it. And it's amazing to just see the different departments all coming together and how this machine, to end up with two cars to race on a Sunday afternoon, everything has to be perfect from start to finish. The lead times, the process, all of the people pulling together at the right time. And then to be successful at it is another step again. And that really fascinates me. I really enjoy that aspect of it. And I think as a driver as well, you do learn all of these skill sets, but in different areas. And then you can see how they're put into practice. And for me, it's fantastic.
Well, Alan, it's brilliant to still have you around. Thank you for a wonderful, wonderful chat. I've really enjoyed it. Final one, and this is a question I'm asking everyone on the pod this year. Formula One is 75 years old this year. Can you just give us a favourite moment in the 75-year history of the sport? It doesn't have to be your career. It could be anything at all.
I think there's a few. I remember standing at Stranraer Kart Circuit when Niki Lauda won in Estoril, the World Championship, and hearing it on the radio in the front of our van, because you would have, it was like the pre-generation of Five Live Sport, and hearing that, and that was the first time I really sort of picked onto it. I remember my dad winning a competition to go to the Monaco Grand Prix when Derek Daly did his flying incident at the first corner, and I was actually sitting at the swimming pool complex, and you know, it was raining and drizzling in there, and I just remember the excitement, noise and everything else, never believing that I was ever coming back. Also, British Grand Prix, 86, standing at Silverstone on the banking, but probably personally, Lewis first laps in the McLaren in Estoril in 1989. And the memory of it is held in the pictures my father took, which was all of the grandstand, because he never got the car in the shot because it was always going through. And so I've got zero pictures of it, but I've got beautiful memories of it.
You were too quick for the old man. Alan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Too quick for the old man, and too quick for many of his rivals in his heyday, because Alan was a wonderfully fast racing driver, and it seems unfair that he didn't have a long and illustrious career in Formula One. Thanks for your time, Alan, and good luck with all things Audi in the coming years. There are exciting times ahead. Well, that's pretty much it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to check out F1's other official podcasts this week. F1 Nation's preview of the United States Grand Prix is out now. I'm joined by F1 TV commentator Jolyon Palmer and former Ferrari race engineer Rob Smedley to discuss whether the rules of engagement between Oscar Piastri and Lando Norris will change now McLaren have secured the Constructors' Championship. And the latest episode of F1 Explains is all about marshals and how they keep the drivers safe. Just search for F1 Nation and F1 Explains on your podcast app. I'll be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audio Boom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.